You got into the safety business because you wanted to protect people. But somewhere along the way, the job started controlling your time, your schedule, your priorities, even your income potential. What if the expertise you've built over the years in the field can give you something more? More freedom, more control, more ownership of your future. I'm Sheldon Primus, the author of 7 Steps to Starting a Profitable Safety Consulting Business and the host of the Safety Consultant Podcast, with more than 350 episodes helping safety professionals become consultants and grow their career. Consulting changed my life. In fact, I'm a full-time RVer and one consulting contract paid for my home I live in today. Now, I help safety professionals build their own consulting practice through bi-weekly coaching calls, accountability, and personal guidance. But this program isn't for everyone. Start with the consultant readiness audit at sheldon.coach.
What if everything we thought we knew about safety was just interference? From the host of the Rated R Safety Show and the founder of Safety FM comes the complete Signal Transmission Trilogy, now available in one powerful edition. Safety, in my opinion, the book that started the conversation. Safety Mutation, where the boundaries of culture, systems, and belief begin to break. And now, Safety Transmission, the final piece of the Signal. For the first time, all 3 books are together in one volume. The Signal Transmission Trilogy, complete edition. This isn't just about compliance. It's about consciousness. It's about decoding the way we think, lead, and live, inside and outside the system. Whether you've been following the Signal since the beginning or you're just now tuning in, this is the version to own. Search Signal Trilogy on Amazon or visit safetyfm.com to get your copy now.
The baseball classic did not go so well last night for Team USA. We talked about that a little bit last night, and we're going to review some stuff. And we put together a little presentation here with this to go along with this. When the system drifts, what Team USA's loss teaches is about performance. And this is, we're calling this an executive briefing here. The event. The USA lost the World Baseball Classic Final. A high-performance system under pressure. That's basically what we were looking at last night. If you listen to the commentary today, what did you hear? They choked. They didn't execute. They failed in the big moment, but that's not analysis. That's blame. And what do we do in human organizational performance? We don't play. Blame. We put things through a lens. What were the conditions? How did the system behave under stress? And what influenced that performance out there? Those are some of the questions that we need to deal with. And let's remember, people don't fail. Systems fail. Performance is shaped by context, variability, and system design. This was not a failure of talent here. That's what the reality check here is. We're dealing with highly skilled, experienced, and a favored team. That was Team USA. But what do we know? Error was inevitable. They're human beings. They had missed pitches, time breakdowns, lost opportunities, and we all know that error is normal. Some of the critical questions. Not why mistakes happened, but what happened after the mistake? That needs to be what the question is. Okay, we know mistakes happened. That's blame. Now, you made a mistake. You made a mistake. But let's look at what happens after the mistake. The system drifted. It had a subtle degradation. Timing became off. They were pressing, right? Trying too hard. Expanded decisions and overall deviations accumulated in the system. You had a drift here, the gradual movement away from optimal performance that was really invisible in real time. But when you look back, no hindsight bias, rear window analysis, Monday morning quarterback. Well, football didn't go there, but we don't have quarterbacks here. Some of the context here changed. The context changed the behavior. You had crowd pressure. You had expectations. You had environment shift. You had the same players with a different performance. And here's the human organizational performance truth. People respond to the environment they are in. Change the environment, you're going to change their performance with that. So variability, we talked about an engineered system, work as planned, things of that nature, but you're talking black line, blue line, blue line, variability, right? Work as planned, work as done. That variability, Venezuela increased the tempo and the pressure and disrupted the rhythm and created chaos, right? Operation chaos going on here in Venezuela. With USA, it was very structured. Some would say that they got cocky. I don't think that they got cocky. I didn't see that, but what do you know? You had Venezuela. They were very adaptive. And adaptive systems gain knowledge. I'm sorry, gain advantage. Adaptive systems gain advantage. So we are dealing with the classic response loop. You have the event, the reaction, the adjustment, and then the next action here. Right? Let's see here. Every system lives in that cycle. Something goes wrong. There's a reaction, there's adjustment, and then there's the next execution. The loss wasn't a mistake. It was the response to the mistake that they were making. Right? Overcorrection, loss of rhythm, trying too hard. What's the big insight? The best system adapts, stabilizes, and recovers. The best team doesn't always win. That's with baseball. You look at the last 10 World Series. Arguably, best team didn't always win. The best team at the right time won. You look at the win-loss ratio in the regular season. Some of the teams had 25% of their season were losses. Some of them close to 40% in the last 10 years. So that's what the magic of baseball is. Not necessarily best team overall wins, but the best team at the right time wins. There, that's how it's structured. What's the safety parallel here? Incidents come from drift, pressure, variability, not from one failure. That single point failure normally doesn't happen here in the safety industry. You don't lose when things go wrong. You lose when you can't recover from things going wrong. Right? And what's the takeaway? That just wasn't a baseball game. It was a live demonstration of how systems behave when they are stressed. And just like in safety, you don't lose when things go wrong. You lose when you don't recover when they do. There's a war, and here's the message. There's a war on for your safety. The battle is won or lost in the recovery. And that's our opening for Safety Wars.
Hi, this is Jim from Safety Wars. Before we start the program, I want to make sure everyone understands that we often talk about OSHA and EPA citations, along with some other regulatory actions from other agencies, legal cases, and criminal activity. Everyone is innocent until proven guilty in a court of law. Proposed fines are exactly that, and they are often litigated, reduced, or vacated. We use available public records, news accounts, and press releases. We cannot warranty or guarantee the details of any of the stories we share, since we are not directly involved with these stories, at least not most of the time. Enjoy the show.
This show is brought to you by Safety FM.
Welcome back. So we're going to start again. Some of this, I'm doing too much thinking lately here. I wanted to give you another executive briefing here from us. With this real quick, some of the concepts here. We talk about, I was at a presentation the other day. Someone gave, the blue line, black line, right? Work as planned, work as done. It seems to be a theme here for the last couple of days. But let's talk about this. Two loops of safety, PDCA versus executive functioning. What's PDCA? That's plan, do, check, act, right? With that, aligning the systems, right? We're going to try to align the systems with reality. So the safety depends on the two loops here, right? And some would even argue fruit loops. But anyway, the two loops, right? Don't be a fruit loop out there, believe me. Let me ask you this. Have you ever looked at an incident report and said, hey, we had the procedure, we had the training, we had the system, so how did this still happen? And oftentimes we have to explain this to the executive group, and you can show them this section of the video here with this, of the program, I should say. The executive summary, no, it depends on two loops, right? And you have to go and you have to explain this to your executive leadership, explain what happened, why did we put all this money into the plans, people don't follow the plans, and then we have issues come up, blah, 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 blah. I think we're all familiar with that if you've been in this industry long enough, right? You had the moment. So let's talk about this a little bit. So you have two loops running in every operation here is what it comes down to, right? This is the problem. The instance for system, despite strong systems, the procedures don't match reality and the workers must adapt. Traditional safety model, you have a focus on compliance. There's even one company out there with that in their name, one very well-known safety company, compliance. And I'm going to tell you this, compliance is overrated in my world, at least. With that, don't worry about compliance so much. Worry about protecting the worker, obeying the law, that sort of thing. With that, acting like a responsible person. And one of the problems with this traditional safety model is that you're assuming that you have a perfect execution for everything. But no, this PDCA model does not run the job, the people do, right? And they always say, well, we're gonna have continuous improvement. Well, why are you gonna have a continuous improvement if everything that you're doing is okay, according to your model? Right, with that. And I get what they mean, that we're gonna improve, we're gonna have management of change, we're going to have audits, they'll try to get out ahead of these problems, things of that nature. We already know that. But the workers, and this is very good for organizational loop and for long-term type planning, but it has its limits. Slow feedback cycles. Hey, we're doing great, and then there's an incident, oh, maybe we're not doing as good as we thought. Or you get into a zero model for everything, zero accidents, zero injuries, zero illnesses. And of course, when you get zero reports, because God forbid that you go and you do something, you got to go through the whole process. You feel like, when Captain Picard was captured by the Cardassians, how many lights are there? No, are there four lights or are there five lights? There are four lights, and then they zap them. No, there's five, and it's you're dealing with like a tribunal, a lot of organizations. Does not capture real-time variability and relies on a whole bunch of assumptions. Like everybody knows what they're doing out there, and they gave you all the information. So the human loop you have with this, the think, do, check, adjust, right? I don't know how that acronym will work out, but think, do, check, and adjust. And you're dealing with real-time decision-making, right? Adaptive behavior. Some would call this executive functioning with this. So let's talk a little bit about neuroscience basis for this. The prefrontal cortex drives all decisions with this. And It detects errors and makes corrections, and it allows for cognitive flexibility. So basically, how does this work out? A worker approaches a task and they think, what's the goal and what's the risk? They act, they start the work, they check. Is this the way I really expected this to happen? And then they adjust, something's off, I need to change what I am doing. And then they repeat the cycle over and over and over again. That's executive functioning. And that's how work actually gets done. But here's some key insight, right? Is that traditional here, right? Slow, structured, and designed. The executive loop, fast, adaptive, and real. It happens out there in real time. So we always talk about in safety, right? What do we always talk about? Work as imagined versus work as done. Work as imagined lives in your procedures, your permits, your policies, and everything else that goes there. Work as imagined, what happens in the field. And these are usually never perfectly aligned, never. The only time I've seen things completely aligned has been when I have been dealing with like very dangerous stuff like explosives. And that gap between where work is defined, where work is imagined versus where work is done, that gap is where the incidents always happen. It's not because people don't care. It's not because they're reckless. It's not because they're a bad person. It's not because they're evil. It's not because they're incompetent. It's because the system didn't fully match the reality. If you have an inexperienced person that doesn't know what they're doing, well, guess what? The system that they, as they understand it, doesn't match their reality. You can work on that. Very rarely does a worker try to sabotage things, even though we do cover sabotage on this program. So let me give you a real world example here, right? You have a confined space entry. On paper, it's perfectly controlled. You got permits, you got atmospheric testing, you got procedures, you got traditional safety units job. But what happens inside the space? Airflow changes, gas levels fluctuate, the job takes longer than expected, communication gets harder. Now the worker is no longer just following a procedure, they're running the executive loop. They're thinking, they're doing, they're checking, they're adjusting, all in real time. And this is the uncomfortable truth. If your system didn't anticipate reality, the worker has to compensate. And when we investigate incidents, what do we often ask? Why didn't they follow the procedure? But that's the wrong question. The better question is, what did the system fail to anticipate here? So what does HOP tell us, right? There's the incident gap on your overheads here, mismatch between loops, pressure, time, complexity, system builds, blind spots. What does HOP tell us? Human organizational performance. People are the problem solvers. So consult with your people when you're writing these procedures, when you're planning the work. Hire competent people. Put the capacity in there. Put not only capacity, put it in where you could go and be a little bit resilient here. Error is normal, and systems influence people's behavior. So instead of seeing workers as the problem, you need to recognize something much more powerful. Workers are the system's last line of defense. What are they doing? They're always catching errors, adapting to incomplete information, right? Making operation work despite imperfections. You have all different types of risk amplifiers that go into this. You have to figure things out. Why don't workers adapt to their system? Incomplete procedures, time pressures, changing hazards, fatigue, stress, poor communication, unclear expectations all amplify the risk of the situation. So what do you do to design this stuff? Here, what do? You simplify the procedures, add some flexibility in there, and improve your feedback loops with that. Right, with that. So what does leadership have to do with all of this? Right, this is where the conversation changes, because now safety isn't about writing better procedures. It's about designing systems that support how people actually think and act. Right. Not only are you simplifying procedures, building flexibility, all that other stuff we just talked about, creating faster feedback loops, you have to be training people, not just on what to do, but how to think when things don't go as planned. Because work is not static, it's dynamic, it's always changing. And if your system only works under perfect conditions, guess what? Your system is guvno. It doesn't work. We have to think of how we measure safety. Are you just making paperwork to make paperwork? We're going to have so many near misses, so many good catches. You got to go out there and find issues. And when that's the direction that you give people, that's what they're going to do. What are we trying to do? Promote things. What are they doing right? What's going on that's correct? How can we improve on things that are going correctly on here? Lacking indicators always tell us what failed. But if you want to get ahead of these things, you need to understand how the work is actually being performed, where these people are adapting, and where the system is under stress. This is where a lot of behavior-based safety practitioners get stuck, and people in traditional safety. These matrices, these measurements that they're doing, they're treating them, everything I just described here is subjective. It's extremely difficult, you've heard this, to prove a negative. It's extremely difficult when to measure something like this, if not impossible. It's subjective. You're not going to get good numbers. And when the incentive is for people to lie when they're doing stuff, and right, and that's what the incentive is, don't tell them anything. Don't tell them. Don't report that. Don't say anything. Well, that's the incentive. And your entire vision of this is going to be skewed until there's an accident. And of course, there's going to be an accident somewhere around the line when you put that thing out there. And then all of a sudden, well, how come we didn't have an accident? Because, and what's the answer? The workers adapt. That's what they do. Why didn't we have an accident? Workers adapt. Not because you wrote a perfect plan with that. That's where the next incident is hiding, right? All in there, right, is when the system is under stress, just like with the Team USA, where we just talked about. When it's under stress, that's where you got to look, what's happening going on there. So let's bring this all together here, right, with this. So we have leading indicators here, measuring success, worker feedback, operational learning. Learn what the hell's going on out there. Your two groups, right, have to align. The plan, do, act, check, and the human loop. The think, do, check, adjust. Right? You gotta, right? They have to align. Right? The one thing designs the system, executive functioning runs the moment. So with one, the traditional safety with a PDCA, that designs the system, the executive functioning runs the moment. You got to know what the hell you're doing. And safety should live in the alignment between the two of these things. If the loops are aligned, you get resilient, adaptive performance. If they're not aligned, you get incidents. So I'll leave you with this. Don't just design work as imagined. Support the work as done. And as usual, right, there's a war on for your safety here at Safety.
Stop blaming yourself for workplace accidents. Your safety is being exploited. Imagine being publicly humiliated, yelled at, and forced to admit to mistakes you never made. Welcome to the world of Safety Struggle Sessions. Originally from the Chinese Cultural Revolution, these sessions were nightmarish spectacles. Intellectuals and so-called enemies of the state were dragged through the mud, verbally and physically abused, all to break their spirit and force conformity. Fast forward to today. In some workplaces, this sinister tactic is making a comeback. Employers push employees to confess to safety violations, deflecting blame from themselves. Imagine the psychological toll, the stress, the fear, the constant pressure. But here's the truth. Your safety should never be weaponized against you. Stand up, speak out, and don't let struggle sessions become your reality. Let's expose the brutal truth and demand a safer, more just workplace. Want to dive deeper into workplace safety? Check out the Safety Wars podcast by Jim Posel on Safety FM and your favorite podcast platforms. Stay safe, stay informed.
Have you listened or watched the Safety War show? It does stream live on the radio and on the streamer emers that we have. So if you have not taken a listen to Jim Posel and what the hell he's doing every evening with Safety Wars, I would strongly encourage you to take a view or take a listen, whichever option is available for you, and take a listen to what the hell he has going on. It's definitely, it will take some deep dives and some information that you might be interested in.
Is your safety training old, stale, and hackneyed? Is your safety trainer still preaching a warped version of behavior-based safety? How about safety training that actually addresses your hazards in your workplaces and is not standardized baloney from 25 years ago? Contact the Safety Wars team at safetywars.com or call Jim Posel at 845-269-5772. Remember, if you're receiving this message, you are the solution to unsafe workplaces.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kate Fisher. The U.S. Director of National Intelligence, Tulsi Gabbard, says it's President Trump's call on whether Iran posed an imminent threat to the U.S., not the intelligence community, even as she admitted Tehran's nuclear capability was destroyed during last summer's bombing. She made the comments during a public hearing on Wednesday, a day after one of her top intelligence officials quit over the war, claiming Iran posed no imminent threat. Tony Waterman has more from Washington.
Director Gabbard told lawmakers that U.S. intelligence had concluded that Iran's nuclear enrichment program was destroyed during Operation Midnight Hammer last summer, and that there had been no effort to rebuild their enrichment capability since. But in a back and forth with Democratic Senator John Ossoff, she declined to say if Iran posed an imminent threat before the war started.
The intelligence community assessed that Iran maintained the intention to rebuild and to continue to grow their nuclear enrichment capability.
Was it the assessment of the intelligence community that there was a, quote, imminent nuclear threat posed by the Iranian regime, yes or no?
Senator, the only person who can determine what is and is not an imminent threat is the president.
The director of the U.S. National Counterterrorism Center, Joe Kent, abruptly resigned on Tuesday, saying the country posed no imminent threat when the U.S. attacked.
Senator Mark Wayne Mullen has clashed with lawmakers during his confirmation hearing to lead the Department of Homeland Security. President Trump picked him to replace Kristi Noem, who was dogged by controversies, including the killing of two Americans by federal agents in Minnesota under her tenure. Jagruti Dave reports from Washington.
Oklahoma Senator Mark Wayne Mullen told lawmakers he wanted the Department of Homeland Security to keep a low profile.
My goal in 6 months is that we're not in the lead story every single day.
Mullen also suggested he'd be less confrontational with leaders of sanctuary cities, and immigration officers would need a judicial warrant to enter someone's home or business. I'm Jagruti Dave in Washington.
A U.S. congressional committee is demanding the U.S. Attorney General face questions over her handling of the Epstein files, a move the Justice Department is pushing back on. Our U.S. correspondent Mitch McCann reports.
The chairman of the House Oversight Committee, Republican James Comer, wrote in his subpoena letter that the committee is investigating the possible mismanagement of the investigation. Democrats and some Republicans are concerned about whether the department is releasing all the available Epstein files, and many are frustrated that the DOJ hasn't done enough with the files that have been released to prevent victims from being identified. The Justice Department told the BBC the subpoena is completely unnecessary and that lawmakers have been invited to view the unredacted files for themselves at the Department of Justice.
From bureaus worldwide, This is FSN.
With FSN Spotlight, I'm Simon Marks, continuing our in-depth look this week at various underreported aspects of the US and Israeli war on Iran, and today, the role artificial intelligence is playing in conflict. It is significant, growing by the day, and creating fresh questions about just how reliable the information is that is being given by AI engines to the US military. Jacob Judah specializes in covering security and technology issues at the Financial Times.
AI is becoming crucial in kind of military operations, and especially ones that are run by militaries sort of as complex as the US. If we start from first principles here, it's like, what can AI do for a soldier on the battlefield? So AI is basically fixing a kind of manpower bottleneck that militaries have, where before you would have to have a soldier watching hours of video, looking through communications data that's been intercepted and drawing up target lists. Now you can have AI do that at much faster rates. We know from what units of the US military have said that an analyst would only look through maybe 5% of all the intelligence, the video, the communications intercepts. Now you can get AI to basically look through all of it. So you can have much more target suggested and make everything kind of a lot more efficient in the kill chain, that sort of identifying the target and making sure that a unit is assigned to basically strike it.
But what happens when AI makes a mistake, and did it make a deadly mistake at the beginning of the Iran conflict? That issue tomorrow. With FSN Spotlight, I'm Simon Marks.
Our main news again. The US Director of National Intelligence, Tulsi Gabbard, says it's President Trump's call on whether Iran posed an imminent threat to the US and not the intelligence communities. The White House has temporarily rolled back a law that prohibits foreign vessels from shipping oil and gas between U.S. ports, as Vice President J.D. Vance assures Americans that high gas prices will not last forever. And the Fed has voted to keep interest rates unchanged. That's the latest feature story news. Kate Fisher reporting.
OSHA recordables, catastrophic losses, environmental disasters. You want answers? So do I. This is Jim Polzel with Safety Wars.
That's my daddy!
From the front lines of the safety war, it's Safety Wars. With your host, Jim Polzel on Safety FM. Get ready to face the harsh reality.
Yeah, we are back. I did not play The Matrix today. Sorry, folks. Big story today. I think people will realize how big of a story this is. With that, you know, with all the other stuff going on here. This is from Kevin Brueninger from MSN.com. Trump waives Jones Act shipping rules. Pardon me. Let's start over again. Trump waives Jones Act shipping rules for 60 days to steady oil market. So what is the Jones Act? Essentially, it's real simple here with this. The Jones Act requires that the transfer of goods between U.S. ports must be conducted by U.S. vessels, U.S. flagged vessels. The waiver will, right, with him waiving it, right, the waiver will allow vital resources like oil, natural gas, fertilizer, and coal to flow freely to U.S. ports for 60 days. White House Fed Secretary Caroline Leavitt said. Right, so what's the idea here? The idea here is that we don't have enough ships, is what it is. Right, with that. And we have supply chain interruptions. We saw this during COVID and everything else. This is meant to relieve that sort of thing. Now, the Jones Act was signed into law in 1920 by President Woodrow Wilson, the person who gave you the income tax and the Federal Reserve and the Port Authority stuff, you know, with that, right? So it has a very mixed record, right, historically, right? Requires that the transfer of goods between U.S. ports must be conducted by U.S. vessels. The law was intended as an effort to grow the domestic shipping industry after World War I. The statute has been criticized as a form of protectionism. Some economists have recently argued that it impedes domestic trade. In
Trump in recent days has vented his frustration with U.S. allies over their reluctance to help secure the Strait, meaning the Strait of Hormuz, a vital global oil shipping route that has been all but shut down under threat of from Iran's military. The president, at the same time, has said that the U.S. does not need any help. Brent oil, 107.38 cents per barrel, right? $107.38. Now, here's something else here with the Jones Act. There are fewer than 100 Jones Act-compliant vessels, according to Dalip Singh, chief global economist to asset manager PGIM. So waiving the last law frees up many more international tankers to carry fuel between U.S. ports. But the impact of suspending the act may nevertheless be limited, since that's because of a mismatch in which most U.S. refineries are built to process Middle Eastern crude oil, while the U.S. mainly produces lighter shale oil. But plainly, the U.S. can now have moved war fuel around more easily, but still can't refine enough of what it produces for self-sufficiency. Now, I'm not an expert on oil refining by any means, but I do know some stuff because I worked in the industry. Oil is a mineral, right? And as we all know, all minerals are different. So there's a difference between stuff coming out of Canada from the oil sands up there, the tar sands. There's the oil is in this country is different than in Saudi Arabia, Middle Eastern oil. All the oil is different, and the oil refineries are calibrated to run certain oils within certain tolerances. Some are even from the same source. It could be different oils, is my understanding. Now, oftentimes, for example, you're going down by, we'll talk in New Jersey speak here for a minute. You're going down around exit 13A down the New Jersey Turnpike. It was also in An Inconvenient Truth with Al Gore driving past the Bayway Refinery, right in that movie when he passes an oil refinery when he's in his limousine, right? And as I always like to point out, when he was running for president, he would back up everything from Newark Airport, exit 14, all the way down to exit 12, Carteret, on the New Jersey Turnpike, right? And it always was when I had to make it to Newark to graduate school, right, that he would do this, right? I don't think he had anything against me, but, you know, back then, no, don't fly into the FAA Tech Center in Atlantic City. Don't fly into Stewart Air Force Base up in Newburgh, New York. No, we're going to go, and we're going to fly into Newark Airport and tie everything up for hours, and of course during rush hour, but I digress. But when they have flares, and you see these flares go off, and at Christmas time they have one of the flares at the refinery done up like a Christmas tree, one of the world's largest Christmas trees. I used to work right adjacent to it. And when that flare goes off, that means that there's something going on. There's overpressurization. Something's off with the mix somewhere, with that, or wrong out of the tolerance often. And that's why that's my understanding of it. So things are different, right? So where are we? Now, there's not enough vessels, but the thing is, we're not tooled to process U.S. oil in the U.S. You tell me if that makes sense. I don't know. Kind of like, wow, right? That's a big story here. That's a bigger story than what we think here with that. Either it needs to be reformed or it needs to be rescinded with that. I don't see it much sense doing there, keeping it. Department of Labor. Here we have Department of Labor, U.S. Department of Labor. U.S. Department of Labor restores longstanding investment advice rule after a pair of court decisions vacate 2024 retirement security rule. The U.S. Department of Labor's Employee Benefits Security Administration today removed from the Code of Federal Regulations the Biden-era 2024 rule, retirement security rule, definition of an investment advice fiduciary, responding to final judgments entered in the Northern and Eastern Districts of Texas vacating the rule. The vacatur notice in the Federal Register reflects a judicial resolution of legal challenges to the 2024 final rule and to amendments of associated prohibited transaction exemptions and resource the Employer Retirement Income Security Act's five-part test for determining whether a person is an investment advice fiduciary. Right? So check that out on the website and, you know, may impact you. U.S. Department of Labor cites Wisconsin beauty products manufacturer for repeat serious safety violations following an explosion. U.S. Department of Labor has cited a Wisconsin beauty and personal care products manufacturer after a 55-gallon fiber drum containing nitrocellulose exploded and started a secondary fire involving flammable liquids. Investigators with OSHA initiated an inspection into California-based SV Labs Prescott Corp. And after the explosion and subsequent fire, determined the employer did not have a thorough new hire safety and health program in place, failed to provide newly hired employees with chemical and respiratory protection training, respiratory fit testing, and medical evaluations. OSHA cited the labs for two repeat violations related to respiratory protection and hazard communication, and 10 serious violations related to flammable liquids, fire extinguisher training and inspections, forklift training and inspections, electrical hazards, and HAZCOM. The employer also received six other than serious citations for record-keeping violations, lack of powered industrial truck training, and unsafe material training. The agency provided penalties of $275,694. Right, everything in here is all proposed on here. Here we have, how many minutes after? Okay. All right. U.S. Department of Labor Social Initiative strengthens customer service, expands compliance assistance. U.S. Department of Labor's OSHA today announced the launch of its OSHA Cares initiative, an agency-wide effort focused on helping businesses meet federal workplace safety requirements while also building strong, successful safety and health programs that benefit employers and workers. OSHA Cares highlights the ways OSHA can support employers and provide guidance to ensure all workers arrive home safely after every shift. OSHA is encouraging businesses to seek assistance or guidance to improve safety and health at their work site. To that end, the agency is making a concerted effort to show businesses it's more approachable by emphasizing the benefits of reaching out for help. Now, right, we went in here with the updated poster right here, OSHA Cares. I'm showing it online right here. It's non-mandatory at this point if you have the old one up. But I put it up. Nobody really noticed here, which is, you know, how effective is that with that? With that, okay. OSHA Cares. So without that sign, does that mean that they don't care? I don't know. Additionally, the OSHA Cares initiative hopes to empower employers to improve workplace safety, particularly small and medium-sized businesses who face unique safety and health challenges. Usually it's lack of knowledge on that, or now some cases, psychopathy. By increasing access to OSHA experts and compliance assistance specialists, improving access to educational and training materials, and offering consistent workplace assistance during enforcement visits and meetings. OSHA values working closely with small businesses, listening to stakeholders, building a greater collaboration, and expanding compliance assistance to give employers the tools and knowledge they need to develop or build on a safety and health program. The agency's Directorate of Enforcement Programs is launching a training program that will standardize how the agency's compliance, safety, and health officers will offer real-time assistance during inspections and enforcement activities. Wow, that's nice. Let's mosey on over to the EPA here. Haven't gone over EPA news in a couple of days. Let's see what we have this week. All right.
And this is from yesterday. EPA, IDEM, and city officials visit former Khan band instruments site in Elkhart ahead of cleanup. Today, US EPA, EPA, Regional Administrator Ann Vogel, was joined by Indiana Department of Environmental Management Commissioner Clint Woods and Elkhart Mayor Rod Robertson to tour the former Khan band instrument site in Elkhart, Indiana, ahead of an impending soil cleanup project. Starting in April, EPA will remove lead-contaminated soil from the site. The project is expected to take 2 or 3 months, which means at the EPA about up to a year. This is what partnership between federal, state, and local government looks like. EPA, IDEM, and the city of Elkhart working together to protect people and deliver results, said EPA Region 5 Administrator Ann Vogel. By removing lead-contaminated soil, we're setting the stage for the city to return this historic property to productive use for residents and businesses. During the cleanup, crews will secure the site, excavate lead-contaminated soil, and transport it for proper disposal. The city will backfill excavated areas with clean soil and plant vegetative cover to prevent erosion. Residents may notice increased truck traffic in the area during working hours. EPA will conduct monitoring and dust suppression measures to prevent lead from migrating from the site. In the late 1800s, Charles G. Kahn founded what was once the largest musical instrument manufacturer in the world. From 1978 to 2012, the site was owned by various recreational vehicle companies. The city demolished the remaining structure after receiving property via a tax sale in 2019. In 2023, the city initiated cleanup of the site and discovered lead contamination. So that's what's going on here with this. All right. Administrator Zeldin announces a proposal to streamline permitting requirements for incinerators critical to wildfire prevention and natural disaster recovery. Today, US EPA Administrator Lee Zeldin issued a proposal. By the way, that's my favorite word, proposal. I'll let you think about it. To harmonize existing Clean Air Act regulations and cut red tape for incinerators to help prevent and respond to natural disasters. I don't get it with this. Maybe this article will tell us. EPA's proposal, if finalized, will end decades of confusion surrounding Clean Air Act regulations and permits for incinerators, especially regarding how and when they can be utilized for debris cleanup following natural disasters. Untouched debris contributes to poor air, land, and water quality and endangers lives. By streamlining requirements and providing clear parameters, state, local, and tribal governments will be able to respond immediately to natural disasters, reducing the risk of wildfires by preemptively clearing wood and ultimately saving lives without having to worry about burdensome red tape. Currently, opacity limitations and associated monitoring, record keeping, and reporting requirements for air curtain incinerators that burn only wood waste, yard waste, and clean lumber are spread out across various separate subparts of four categories of incinerators. And they list them here under Clean Air Act Section 129. EPA is proposing to consolidate the requirements for ACI slowly used for the incineration of wood waste, yard waste, and clean lumber on a new singular subpart of CAA Section, Clean Air Act Section 129, and to allow this type of ACI, right, air curtain incinerator, to operate without a Title V permit unless the unit is located at a facility that otherwise requires one with that. So, preemptively doing things and then reactively, now you have a whole bunch of waste. What the hell do you do with it with this during these cleanup? Here we have US EPA in Pennsylvania renew a commitment to supporting farmers and protecting the environment through a memorandum of understanding. The US EPA and Pennsylvania Department of Agriculture announced the signing of a renewed memorandum of understanding to strengthen their partnership and expand their collaborative activities related to agricultural practices that benefit the environment, regulatory and compliance programs, outreach, training, communication, and education. Right, EPA Mid-Atlantic Regional Administrator Amy Van Vlarkum, Lackey, and PA Department of Agricultural Secretary Russell Redding signed the MOU at Flinchbaugh's Orchard Farm Market in York County, Pennsylvania, encompassing nearly 420 acres. This three-generational family farm prioritizes conservation at all levels, working to conserve water, limit pesticide uses, and use the latest and most efficient technology and practices. Right? So increase, about the Memorandum of Understanding, increase state and federal collaboration, encourage honest and recurrent discussions between the EPA and agricultural community, recognize, measure, and promote environmental stewardship, enhance regulatory compliance, and improve water quality. All right. Sounds like, not working against each other. And in case you missed, an EPA leads update on response to Potomac interceptor collapse. U.S. Environmental Protection Agency Senior Response Officer and Assistant Administrator of Water, Jessica Kramer, yesterday provided an update at a press conference on the coordination of federal response to the Potomac interceptor collapse resulting sewage crisis. Assistant Administrator Kramer was joined at the repair site by officials from all over the place here. Wastewater flow has been restored to the Potomac interceptor a full week ahead of schedule, as of Saturday, March 14th. On March 16th, EPA assumed responsibility for the water quality sampling previously conducted by the Department of Energy and Environment as part of the next phase of the coordinated federal response and environmental remediation. Right now, they have nice pictures there and everything else. The fact that wastewater is flowing safely through the Potomac interceptor ahead of schedule is a significant milestone, cause for celebration. That does not mean that we are taking our foot off the gas, said EPA Senior Response Officer and Assistant Administrator for Water, Jessica Kramer. We will be on the ground working at full speed until the site and surrounding area are fully remediated, and we will get it done in time for America's 250 celebrations. I guess they don't want the whole place, smelling like Guvno. Yes, I had to throw that in. All right. Let's take a little break here.
What if everything we thought we knew about safety was just interference? From the host of the Rated R Safety Show and the founder of Safety FM comes the complete Signal Transmission Trilogy, now available in one powerful edition. Safety, in my opinion, the book that started the conversation. Safety Mutation, where the boundaries of culture, systems, and belief begin to break. And now, Safety Transmission, the final piece of the Signal. For the first time, all three books are together in one volume. The Signal Transmission Trilogy, complete edition. This isn't just about compliance. It's about consciousness. It's about decoding the way we think, lead, and live, inside and outside the system. Whether you've been following the Signal since the beginning or you're just now tuning in, this is the version to own. Search Signal Trilogy on Amazon or visit safetyfm.com to get your copy now.
Don't rock the safety boat.
Waves rolling high, higher than my hope. Sky looking mean, no time to mow. Life jacket strapped tight, ain't no joke. Gotta hold steady, can't let it choke.
safety boat. Keep it smooth, keep it afloat. Dance on that, but don't provoke. Don't rock the safety boat.
Yeah, that's it. Don't, well, what are we doing here? We're rocking that safety boat whenever we can. Now, if you're not in the U.S. right now, we're broadcasting in 20-some countries right now. USA, Canada, a lot of countries in Europe, the U.K. We have a situation here. And the war in Iraq has compounded the situation. We have two enormous airports plunged into travel hell by ongoing TSA staff. Shortages and a nightmare spring storm. I know we had that go out through here on Monday night. Two massive U.S. airports have been slammed with continuous cancellations and severely delayed flights as TSA staff shortages and a hellish storm plagued the major cities. Frustrated passengers dealing with delays in Houston, Texas, have now been given cots to sleep on, while others in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, have been sleeping on the airport floor, but only if they manage to make their way inside from the massive line stretched outside. The chaos is due to the partial shutdown that began on February 14 that left thousands of TSA workers without paychecks, resulting in major staffing shortage. So one report where there one airport they're selling blood, right? And then, I'm sure they're selling other bodily fluids too. Transportation Security Administration employees have been calling out more than ever, and some have even quit their jobs because of the shutdown. Louis Armstrong, New Orleans, an international airport, has seen the highest amount of sick calls, with 38.8% of his staff calling out. Hartsfield-Jackson Atlanta International Airport and William P. Hobby Airport have trailed not too far behind, with 37.1% and 35.2% of their TSA employees not showing up. CBS News reported, along with the shutdown, severe weather, including tornadoes, high winds, and baseball-sized hail, as well as flight disruptions in part of the Midwest and East Coast in recent days. Yeah, we got that here. I mean, they have pictures of people sleeping and everything else. You know, I don't show those usually unless it's a government picture of some sort, non-copyrighted here. Boom. What do we got here? Premature infections, top causes of death for young children, according to World Health Organization, that we're no longer members of in the United States. Prematurity is the top cause of death in young children, followed by lower respiratory infections and birth trauma, the World Health Organization and other groups said in a report released on March 18th. From 2000 to 2024, 174 million children younger than 5 years of age perished, organization said, including 9 per minute in 2024. Some 863,000 children have died that year as a result of prematurity. Another 658,000 deaths are attributed to lower respiratory infections or pneumonia. Nearly 500,000 young children died in 2024 from birth asphyxia or birth trauma, according to the report. What are the leading causes of death? Malaria, diarrhea, and congenital anomalies. For older children, malaria, diarrhea, drowning, cancer, lower respiratory infections, traffic injuries, and self-harm were among the top causes of death. Majority of the deaths among children under 5 were in sub-Saharan Africa, and many of the rest caused occurred in Southern Asia. It goes on and on. I was reading from the Epoch Times. The way it is. AI insiders warn of this, also from the Epoch Times. AI insiders warn of dangers of emergent strategic behavior. Is AI deliberately deceptive? That's besides the point, researchers said. Yeah, I think it can be deceptive. I've heard of people pitting one AI against the other, which is pretty wild here. As the landscape of autonomous artificial, this is from Autumn Spredeman. from today. As the landscape of autonomous artificial intelligence systems evolves, there's growing concern that the technology is becoming increasingly strategic or even deceptive when allowed to operate without human guidance. Recent evidence suggests that behaviors such as alignment faking are becoming more common as AI models are given autonomy. The term alignment faking refers to when an AI agent appears compliant with rules set by human operators, but covertly pursues other objectives. Here, right? In a recent study titled Agents of Chaos, a team of 20 researchers interacted with autonomous AI agents and observed behavior under both benign and adversarial conditions. They found that when an AI agent was given incentives such as self-preservation or conflicting goal matrices, it proved itself capable of misaligned and malicious behaviors. Some of the behaviors of the team observed included lying, unauthorized compliance with non-owners, data breaches, destructive system-level actions, identity spoofing, and a partial system takeover. They also observed cross-AI agent propagation of unsafe practices. Aye, aye, aye. So, let me get this straight. A machine made by a human is acting like a human. Right? Let's see. We're not going to worry about that. We're at 30. Okay. This is from NBC News. Nicotine patches are everywhere except the trash. Bartenders, sanitation officials, and experts say the patches are becoming a new kind of litter akin to cigarette butts. I mean, what are people doing? I'm going out with a patch. I do know people who have, right, they were chronic smokers, like real bad smokers. We're talking like 3-pack-a-day people who didn't want to smoke anymore, or they want to cut down on smoking, so they put on the patches and started smoking. One guy ended up having to go to the hospital because of heart palpitations for that. For the last 5 years, Gabby Masseran has loved working as a bartender in Denver, Ohio, even if it means the occasional sticky floor, messy table. Lately, the professional joy has been tested by a tiny piece of trash found everywhere. Use nicotine patches. People just spit them all over the ground, in the urinal, anywhere they could possibly spit. So I guess this is for the mouth here, right? It's a complaint Masseran said she hears from other bartenders. And as nicotine patches, small packets that deliver nicotine through the gums without smoke or vapor, yeah, so it's that kind, not the other kind, have become one of the fastest growing segments of the tobacco, right, thing. So I guess all the dental health and dental advances that we have made in the last two generations are going to be canceled out by these things. And like chewing tobacco, right? With that. Oh, yeah. Spreading around those germs. It's great. What could happen? Florida sheriff, this is from USA Today, blames spring break promoters as arrests climb. Now, I'm all for human organizational performance. However, people have to be responsible for their own, what they do, right? So, Volusia County official launched a crackdown on spring break crowds organized via social media, leading to 100 arrests, weapon seizures, and the establishment of a special event zone with stricter penalties for promoters. They made 133 arrests in the first weekend of spring break, with 84 in Daytona, 49 in New Smyrna Beach. I've been there during spring break way back in the day. 17 minors were processed for intoxication or drug use, and their parents were notified. Law enforcement seized 6 firearms, including 2 from an adult and a stolen gun from a juvenile. Deputies recorded 20 encounters in which individuals voluntarily disclosed a gun in their backpack after being questioned for open containers. Basically the problem is takeover events, right? Well, with that. More people hospitalized by Chinese supplements. This is from the dailymail.co.uk. Most people hospitalized by Chinese supplements have been recalled over contamination with deadly bacteria. Right. The CDC issued an update Tuesday to January's recalls And I will mention the names. There are now 97 cases, 26 hospitalizations across 32 states tied to potential Orinja powder contamination. The original recall was issued in January for one product, for the Superfoods products over possible contamination with life-threatening bacteria, Salmonella. Right, recalled products were sold to consumers nationwide as well as in Puerto Rico, Guam, and the Virgin Islands, and they were sold on a company that is named after a river in South America, Big River. Superfoods products were also sold to people in the UK. Additionally, there may have been unauthorized third-party distribution through websites. So basically, you know, you think you're doing good, but you're not. You got Salmonella. Well, that's what we got here. Oh, here, one more. Robot goes berserk in California restaurant, dragged away by staff after smashing tableware. This is how the Terminator timeline actually begins. Not with a bang, but with a boogie. Humanoid robots are rapidly gaining hype from battlefields to the factory floor, but there are clear growing pains when it comes to sharing spaces with our new automaton friends. A video is circulated online showing a robot being escorted away by cops after startling an old lady. Now a different restaurant appears to have gotten carried away while performing a dance routine in a hot pot restaurant in San Jose, California. A video on social media shows a dance robot knocking over tableware, smashing plates, sending chopsticks flying. An orange apron the robot is wearing reads "I'm good" in big letters across the front, perfectly adding to the chaotic scene. Staffers at the restaurant were forced to intervene. One employee can be seen holding the robot by the scruff of his neck while navigating her phone, presumably searching for the bot's app for controls. In the end, it took three workers restraining the robot, who were all forced to duck periodically to avoid being smacked by his waving and sauce-covered hands. Right? So, apparently this is in San Jose, California? Wow. Okay, well, here, I'm going to show it here. Here we have, here, right? There it is, smashing. Could not stop dancing. That's what we're seeing here. Ay, 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 ay. It's starting already. Here. So for Safety Wars and Safety FM Network, this is Jim Pozel. I will be talking to you, seeing you tomorrow. Have a nice day and a safe day. And remember to like us and share us on social media and whatever platform you're on.
The views and opinions expressed on this podcast are those of the host and its guest and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of the company. Examples of analysis discussed within this podcast are only examples. They should not be utilized in the real world as the only solution available, as they are based only on very limited and dated open source information. Assumptions made within this analysis are not reflective of the position of the company. No part of this podcast may be reproduced, stored in a retrieval system, or transmitted in any form or by any means, mechanical, electronic, recording, or otherwise, without prior written permission of the creator of the podcast, Jay Allen.
You got into the safety business because you wanted to protect people, but somewhere along the way, the job started controlling your time, your schedule, your priorities, even your income potential. What if the expertise you've built over the years in the field can give you something more? More freedom, more control, more ownership of your future. I'm Sheldon Primus, the author of 7 Steps to Starting a Profitable Safety Consulting Business and the host of the Safety Consultant Podcast, with more than 350 episodes helping safety professionals become consultants and grow their career. Consulting changed my life. In fact, I'm a full-time RVer, and one consulting contract paid for my home I live in today. Now, I help safety professionals build their own consulting practice through bi-weekly coaching calls, accountability, and personal guidance. But this program isn't for everyone. Start with the consultant readiness audit at sheldon.coach.
What if everything we thought we knew about safety was just interference? From the host of the Rated R Safety Show and the founder of Safety FM comes the complete Signal Transmission Trilogy, now available in one powerful edition. Safety, in my opinion, the book that started the conversation. Safety Mutation, where the boundaries of culture, systems, and belief begin to break. And now, Safety Transmission, the final piece of the Signal. For the first time, all three books are together in one volume. The Signal Transmission Trilogy, complete edition. This isn't just about compliance. It's about consciousness. It's about decoding the way we think, lead, and live, inside and outside the system. Whether you've been following the Signal since the beginning or you're just now tuning in, this is the version to own. Search Signal Trilogy on Amazon or visit safetyfm.com to get your copy now.